From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The stories in David Crane's new collection are all over the place. Different characters with different histories. Some of the stories are dark and surreal, others are wistful and charming. The only thing that really ties them all together is the setting. The people who inhabit the stories have all, for some reason or another, made their way to Idaho. There are probably bits of Crane's himself in all of these stories. He says most of his work takes its impulse from the things he himself has experienced. The water and the fishing is a common element you'll detect right off the bat, but after that it's harder to tell what Idaho reveals about the writer. There's love in there and relationships, but also regret and a little rage, too. Today in the program, David Crane's is coming by for a conversation, and we invite you to listen in after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So who knows how much of a writer's life gets revealed in the stories they create? Some say the elements and characters are just made up, products of a process of imagination, maybe. David Crane's has said a good part of his work takes its impulse from something he himself experienced at one point or another. So Crane's stories, he says, don't really begin as ideas, but as images or sounds or voices. But once he says he has the story in mind, then he's got to figure out what he calls the best container for that story. And over the years, he's found a lot of them, novels and plays and radio dramas and short stories. His latest book is a collection of stories, all quite different, of course, each from each other, except, of course, maybe the setting. They all take place in Idaho. And why? That's part of what we're hoping to learn today. We're talking with David Crane's today, and you can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You can join us also on Facebook or on Twitter. David Crane's is a playwright, an essayist, a consultant to the gambling industry, which I want to talk about, the author of seven novels, two volumes of short stories, including his latest, which is called The Legend's Daughter. We should also mention that David is going to be giving a book reading of this new collection at the King's English Bookshop in May. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. David Crane's, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Derek.
Well, I wanted to start with, I'm looking for, in the stories, I'm looking for David Crane's, I guess, in there. And one of the things I kept coming back to, because it was a common element, which I want to talk about, was fishing. Fly fishing is important for you.
It is, but it's important to me to be on the water and walk the water. I think that as a very young person, environments of water were exciting to me and cleansing to me, and they set my imagination off so that, yes, fly fishing.
That's just an excuse to get on the water.
It is. I fish with very graceful fly fishermen. I'm a clumsy fly fisherman, and I've had my share of accidents on the water. But that's part of the excitement too, that there's a danger there, but it's moving on water is thrilling to me and very, very stimulating.
Why do you think? What is it about water? Is it about the beauty of it? Is there something fluid about it that resonates with the way you want to write or something?
Well, I think it's amniotic.
Yeah.
I think it goes back that far. And because it is amniotic, in a way, it gives birth to the imagination and frees the imagination to mature and become what it will become. I think there is that kind of – that connection is that deep.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever it might be, it's deep inside, I guess, right?
And when I was a lad a long time ago, I go back to, say, 4 or 5 and spent summers always lakeside. And walking the rocks at the edge of the water was for me revelatory. I became, in those moments, a very different child, not a shy, not a withdrawn, not a speechless child. I became someone who was empowered in some ways, which I didn't understand. And I would have conversations in my head that I couldn't have if I were sitting in the living room or dining room of the house I grew up in.
So water opened you up.
It did. Absolutely. There was a huge freeing of something I didn't understand at that point, but
you think
certainly,
you understand it? Do you understand it now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, well, it is the freeing of possibility, of imagination.
Yeah. It's so interesting, though. You've talked about the fact that coming west also did that. It had that sort of opening kind, and I guess in a quite literal way. Whereas you grew up in New England, of course, and you've talked about how when you came here, of course, there's the physical environment which opens up. You have sky, you have mountains, you know, open spaces. You didn't really have, I suppose, in New England. Did you feel sort of constricted in some way in New England?
Well,
you didn't really?
I mean, physically and environmentally, that. Yes, of course. There are trees. You don't see the sky. You don't see very far at any place most of the time, except when you go to the shore. But the Boston area, and bless Boston and for what they've been going through and the courage that's been happening there. But the Boston area is an area, and the president referred to that today at the memorial service, of great people, of high-powered professional people. My father was in the medical community. He was one time chief of staff at the MGH. I can remember a dinner at our house where there were two Nobelists at the dinner table. Mm-hmm. So it was a daunting it really pressed in on me. I felt I can never be the sort of person that I am surrounded by in my parents' circle of friends. Mm. It's just how does one of the friends was a famous radiologist who has a procedure in radiology named after him, who also concertized with the Boston Symphony. How do you do that? I mean, and my father was wonderful. And that just I'll tell this last story about why it was hard to feel myself as being possible. He used to, when he came back from his medical day, we would have dinner, and there was always a question at the dinner table from the current events that we were supposed to respond to. He wanted us to know the world and know what was happening in the world. And I would try to respond to it. My brother would try to respond to it. And the usual first reaction he had was, I don't understand what you're saying. What are you saying? Wow. He was trying to get us to express ourselves clearly and to use words. The good thing of all of this is I was a young person surrounded by a sea of words, and that was that ultimately paid off.
But that was a little frightening.
Well, it was not. It was. I just felt that I was mute. I was a person who could not express himself.
Yeah.
That was the message I was getting daily or nightly. And so when there were, I think that was the walking the water in on the lake. I discovered that there were words inside me.
Wow.
And I think moving into an environment that was open. When I finished, the doctorate I have is from Yale Drama School in the playwriting program.
Yeah.
And I knew I had to get a day job. I couldn't just write. And so I applied to universities, and three of the four offers were at Eastern schools. And something in me sensed that if I went to an Eastern school, I'd still be held in by what all that meant, all the sort of powerful professionalism that meant, or being involved in the profession. So I crossed the threshold and went out west. And the first year I was here, I wrote twice the amount of work that I did in the same time than I did when I was in the New England area. part of the sense of freedom is I was a pre-med student as an undergraduate with an pre-med with an English major. I applied to law school to medical schools. Something in me froze up and said, "I can't do this at the last moment.
Wow.
I can't be my doctor father's son."
Yeah.
And so, well, what else do you do that's of worth in the world? I love words, so lawyers use words. So I applied to a bunch of law schools and got into Columbia Law School and went there. And lasted about a year before I had a breakdown. Mm-hmm. And at the point of the breakdown, sort of coming out of the breakdown, I said, I can't sort of try to mold myself into some image that's been presented to me from outside. I love to write. I'm going to do it. I'll find a way to do it. So that was part of it. I mean, there was this hunger, this urge, this drive to do this thing, and yet there were forces always on, and I associated them with the East Coast and with the Boston high intellectual community. And so changing that had a huge effect. I've gone on about this. I'm sorry.
No, but it's I wonder if what's left of New England in you, do you think?
That's a very good question. My older son is living now and has been living in the Boston area and is living now in the town next to the town I grew up in. And so I go back. And his statement when he moved there was that to that town, which was just almost right there where I'd grown up, was that he'd reclaimed the family territory. So for him, he feels a great pride, although he loves the West and he loves Idaho in particular. And I go back and I'm now able to see things and feel things and follow impulses that I hadn't before. A crazy story one time back visiting my son. I rented a car and was driving through Cambridge and to go to, I can't remember what my destination was, but suddenly I started to hear piano music and I heard this piano music and I was in my head, or where was the piano music coming from? And I turned to my right and I realized I was just passing the street where for 7 years I took piano lessons from an old woman. And it is a bizarre sort of experience. So that there were positive senses and memories and images stored, and sounds, I guess. So when I go back and I think the best of that rises to the top now, and that's nice. That's a nice feeling, and it's nice to see my son and his wife excited about the lives they live because they are in a highly stimulating community.
I wonder about this. I want to talk about the collection, of course, of stories. Did you intend to create a collection as you were going of stories that came from Idaho, or did it just happen that that's what happened?
You're right. It just happened. I write too much. At one point, the university wanted my papers, and so I started going through my files, and I discovered three novels that I'd forgotten I'd written. Recently, I got from a Japanese publisher who wanted a story of mine to go into an anthology with the best of Richard Ford the list was daunting or exciting. And so they were asking for the rights to translate it, and they sent me a contract. And I remember the story was called Teresa, and I remembered I wrote a story called Teresa, and I know it was published, but I can't remember what it was about or where it was published. So I had to research myself in the process. Yeah, so the stories happened over a span of years, and at one point I thought, well, I've got 9 stories or 10 stories that are set in Idaho. Why not see if I can find her. And Tory House has been a really very, very, very good to me. And it's a wonderful publisher. I like the way they go about things and the sorts of books they produce.
Well, I want to jump into some of these stories because I want to work through some of them, if you're okay with that. I wanted to start with the first of the collection. We may as well just start there, I guess. It's a piece called Where I Am, Where I've Been. And two characters, Clifford and Woods. And I'm going to be careful, David Cranes, throughout. I promise you not to give too much away of these stories. But let's just start with Woods. Let me ask you this, first of all. Where did this begin? I mean, I said this in the introduction, and I want to actually talk a little more about it with you. But you talk about how it isn't necessarily the idea. That's not where it starts for you. It's an image or a picture or a voice. What was the thing that got you started with this story? Do you remember?
I don't. I think the germ of the story was the fact that I had observed people along the water who seemed to be there for the first time and were unsure of themselves, were unsure of the protocols. And I thought, well, what if someone like that who wants to do the right thing and isn't sure what the right thing is travels to this place with somebody who knows too much, who is too daring and too free in the environment.
Yeah.
So it's that sense of balancing a character who's rigid and contained with somebody who is out there.
Yeah.
In all ways, yeah.
And Woods is the rigid one, of course,
yeah.
And bound by the rules, bound by almost by the land itself, and it seems like the water is giving him a new sense of the possible.
Yeah, yeah. It's an initiation story, and so
yeah.
I mean, I started with the idea of an initiator and a novice on that river. In that environment, in that town, a little small, rugged town with very small population, and you probably know the Stanley Basin. So it was an initiation, and there were all sorts of initiations going on, even at a distance. His wife was sending; he was getting a sense of his wife changing her life.
Yeah.
So it was, how do you deal with this change? How do you?
I wondered about the experience of fishing as it applies to this story. I mean, is it for you solitary or is it social? Woods experiences both with Clifford. There are moments when Clifford disappears.
Yeah.
And he feels – and especially this particular moment I'll have you read in a moment where he is so alone he feels bereft and terrified. But then – that's part of the appeal as well, right? I mean, being alone yet then having the connection, is it a give and take for you?
Yeah,
those
I think
things?
For me, the best fishing is solitary.
Yeah.
I am just walking the water with no one else around. At the same time, at first, because I fished with some very good fishermen, Mr. Metcalf, one of them.
Yeah, Jeff Metcalf.
That's got
to be a social experience, fishing with Jeff Metcalf, doesn't it? Or
yeah.
Is it?
Well, it is before and after.
Yeah.
But he's a good teacher.
Yeah.
So when you start, you know, at the beginning of the day, there may be something he helps you with, but I think it is a solid and it's hard for some people to be alone. I mean, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of this story that when the initiator disappears from he who is being initiated, what do you do?
Yeah. All right. I'm going to have you read this section if you would. It's, I was always sort of not sure where I stood with Clifford. I wasn't sure if I trusted him. I didn't know what, that's what I liked about that story is I wasn't sure about him. And I felt for Woods in some ways, is this guy on the up and up? I didn't really know for sure. And Woods is going through this deeply personal experience, these two. And we should just mention, Clifford has brought, as you said, has taken Woods with him up to Idaho. It's his first experience for the most part. And he's going through all of these kinds of changes. Anything else we need to say to set this up?
I don't think so.
Okay,
we'll just do it. In the late afternoon, sun just above the trees, Clifford asked Woods if he would be all right on his own for a while. He said he was going to work the river down and then upstream by himself. Then they could think about quitting. Woods said he'd be fine. He watched Clifford pumping his arm in a steady rhythm, left, then right, solid, relaxed at home. He saw a fish, larger than what they had been catching, rise to what Clifford had called a humpy, and then watch the fish and Clifford play each other in a kind of dance, until Clifford coaxed the fish into his net. "Great!" Woods called down the length of water. But if Clifford heard, he didn't turn, he didn't respond. When Clifford disappeared, Woods suddenly felt vulnerable and alone. It wasn't the water, it wasn't a feeling that he might again stride out of his depth and be swept away by an element he couldn't measure and didn't understand. That prospect, truth told, beguiled him, felt hypnotic. It was that the man had been so good, Clifford. It was that the man had been so caring all day and had been so patient. It was that Woods felt embraced and wondered why this strange, eccentric man had 1 minute bookish, the next manic, had invited him to travel so far from Bethesda. Woods felt himself well up. He began to cry, the light diminishing. He stood thigh deep in a quiet eddy and a flood of tears. He felt loved by what? Something, the world? And confused in that. He felt attached, yet there were all these images. Images of Beth Ann that kept coming in. Beth Ann and Daria, the two in some small cafe or a concert. And their two faces were like twins, so alike, so satisfied, composed. What was he seeing? Were his and Clifford's faces alike? A trout struck his fly where he had allowed it, downstream to drift, unattended. He played the fish, brought it in. Clifford's voice spoke in his head, coaching him. In his net, the fish looked like the infant he and Beth had lost after Clark and Michelle in the hospital. Woods released himself to an almost trumpeted sobbing. The water grew dark, then darker. The light, just a filtering weight in the trees.
It's David Crane's reading from one of the stories in his collection. This is called Where I Am, Where I've Been. The collection is called The Legend's Daughter. He's going to be giving a reading of the book at the King's English Bookshop on Saturday, May 11th in the evening. There you can visit our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer David Cranes is our guest. Cranes found a sense of freedom when he came to the West from New England years ago. Many of his stories are not only set there, but in the West, to have characters and themes that come from the land and water and the sky in the West. His new collection of stories comes from images and scenes he found in Idaho, so we're talking about the characters he's created. The collection is called The Legend's Daughter, Stories by David Cranes, and he's giving a reading in May. We'll give you the details about that later as we go along. I want to talk about the title story of the collection, The Legend's Daughter. Tommy Bachman is the narrator, the main character here. He survives an accident which changes him. He stops drinking, gives away his guitar. And he's in this odd situation where his very briefly known 16-year-old stepdaughter runs away. He's left by her mother. So he has a relationship with a young girl. Laura is her name. She barely knows him, can't really stand him. He isn't really connected to her in any meaningful way except for the fact that he had this brief relationship with her mother. But he does the decent thing. He goes looking for her. And I guess the question is, well, the first question, I suppose, is where did this come from? Where did this story come from? And why is he going looking for her?
Where did the story come from? I have found Idaho to be, and it may be just the circumstances or the encounters I've had, a place where people whose lives have been broken in one way come and try to find a new configuration, a new constellation from to get them out of their brokenness and to give them and out of their solitude. And it's a strange environment to determine what the possibilities are. It's not Boston. It's not Bethesda. Yeah. You have to go sometimes distances to find that which might heal you or console you or reconfigure your life.
Yeah.
So Tommy starts as a caretaker. He's yep. caretaking a ranch. That's the beginning of caring again after a broken life.
Yeah. And then he comes across, by circumstance, Lainey Lou, who is headed out, as she says, into the wilderness to find her father. Her father was this musician whose star had risen and had since sort of fallen, and he disappeared. But she's looking for him. And there comes a moment when Tommy speaks at a memorial. I won't say much more than that, but he talks about his own flight, and he talks about his own experience with a crash, with an accident. And he talks about how he says this. He says, you can want a life and to escape a life at the same time. He says it's hard to find people.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And the story, I'm the worst interpreter of my own stories, but I'll try here. There is a father looking for a daughter and there is a daughter looking for a father.
Right.
We make our families as we can.
Yeah. There comes this time when Tommy is helping Laura, and she sees his hands, and she sees in his hands maps. I want to have you read a section here in a moment, but explain this imagery, because she starts to see maps really all over his body. Where did that come from?
In a mapless terrain, which a lot of Idaho is, I've driven on some of those old lumber roads on my way to ponds and fishing streams. So in a mapless terrain, it's nice to find a map. I think that was it. There's got to be a map somewhere.
And here it is.
And here it is, yeah, in the flesh of someone else.
Here's a section I want to have you read from this story. This is The Legend's Daughter. It'll become clear what's going on. She's basically using Tommy's body as this flesh GPS system.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Bachman did as instructed. They took Idaho 55, bypassing Boise, driving through Horseshoe Bend, Placerville, Banks, and Smith's Ferry. To the east of the west, farmers burned their fields, making the sky, the light, a gauzy green. You know, I have to tell you, I'm a little scared, Lainey Lou said. I'm scared as shit about all this. Except, I don't know what all of this is, Bachman said. Your skin, the map, the messages, Lainey Lou said. My skin, the map, the messages, Bachman repeated. Your skin, the map, the messages, Lainey Lou said. They drove 20 minutes in silence. It was 4 in the afternoon, the light the color of alfalfa dust, magpies wherever there was roadkill. "Anyone ever use you as a Rand McNally before?" Laney Lou asked. "I don't even know what you're talking about," Backman said. "I think where we're going is where beyond is McCall," Laney Lou said. 14 miles, Backman said. "That's what your back says." "That's what my back says?" "McCall," Laney Lou said.
I love this section. Yeah, she's using his skin.
Body is a roadmap.
That's amazing. Okay, so let me see if I get this right. The thing that got you started with the story Angel of Death was kind of this revelation from a friend that, hey, David, there's a mushroom out there in Idaho that is really deadly. Is that the image that got you started?
Yes, it is. It is. And he said it's called an angel. He knew mushrooms. He picked mushrooms. He knew what was edible and what wasn't edible. The wonderful mushrooms, they're almost as good as steaks that occur after a fire. Anyway, he said there is this mushroom out, and it was in the area where we were. And if you touch it, it's almost the paramedics can't get to you fast enough. So the idea that in this landscape, in this Idaho, that I found very freeing in many, many ways and a kind of teacher and a place that you came when things were confusing and they fused together, the river of no return, that there was something really lethal there, became the germ for a story, and I didn't know how I would use it. Obviously, at some point, someone had to come in close contact with it, and whether it was a mortal experience or something beyond a mortal experience was the question. So that was the germ of the story anyway. Yeah.
The storyteller, he starts this church, this first church of Idaho, as he puts it early on in the story, because of love. And his father is an impatient man. He's a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. Impatient, as you say, leached of love, restless, a man without passion or ecstasy or really a sense of the sacred. And the storyteller is looking for God, basically. And he arrives in Idaho, a believer, someone hungry in more and more desperate ways to ascend through love. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah. And because he has an inaccessible father, he starts, if we psychologizing, he's looking for his father.
Yep.
And what's the next step is to find a metaphysical father. I mean, in my own growing up, because I didn't have achieved the closeness to my father, my busy physician father, that I wanted, I thought that I would become, go into the ministry. That was my first thought in high school of sort of seeing the direction of my life. I would go into the ministry.
I'm so glad you went there because I didn't, it would be so doofy if I brought up the fact, is this at all related to your father? So I'm so glad you did, but that is so... So he was inaccessible in some ways. Your father was to you.
Yeah. And so the next thing is to find the father that is accessible.
Yes.
And if it's a spiritual father, then you go there. And it's this kind of thumbing your nose at the father. Look at the father I have now. I mean, I have people come in to my congregation.
As I said, he arrives in Idaho and he's this believer and he finds this woman he was supposed to meet. Lila is her name. And he, you know, it's – I think this is the thing that really – again, I'm not going to give anything away. I promise.
It's okay.
Because it's –
It's free.
It's amazing. He's a gentle soul But his father has shown up there in Idaho where he has come to create this church because of love. And his father shows up and he's full of anger and rage. And he's surprised by that. And I'm surprised by that as the reader of all of that. I have to say I don't know quite how to react about that. Say something about that, about this relationship. He's this loving soul, and he's becomes filled with something else, at least for a while.
The central character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it just seems so pretentious, or the irony that this man had nothing to do with him and now shows up to be paid attention to.
Yeah.
Enrages him. How dare he do this? You know, I have found my father. I have built the Church of Idaho. And he comes into this. It's the snake in the garden.
Yeah. I guess I was surprised, though, how far he goes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
I'm alluding to something that I don't want to give away, but I do want to have you read a section here because it's terrific. I'm going to warn listeners that there's a reference to oral sex, so just be sort of prepared for that. There's not much more than that. It doesn't get into detail. But this is early on in the story. And just to maybe mention a couple of things, he has a lovely relationship with his mother, who he would sleep with at night, and she would hold on to his ankles. There's a reference to that. There's also a reference to a woman who once asked him, "Tell me every time you fell in love," which I thought was lovely, too. We'll hear references to those. But I'm not sure there's anything else I need to set that up with. Is there, David Crane?
No, I think that's okay.
If you would.
Okay. And this is the narrator. This is not me when I start this. The narrator is saying to the reader, "You ask, what is the first church of Idaho? I say, in the beginning, and mention my mother's hands, my ankles, my father's corrupting restlessness. I say, I enter any building under a cross. I remember, tell me every time I use the word intersection. Blood will enter this story. Bones, fire, poison. This is, after all, a religious story. Charred and of blood conversion. Liturgy with a flamed razor. I don't mind speaking in tongues. I embrace it. The woman I love speaks in tongues. Then not. She moves in and out, at once serpent and hostess, often confusing the two. She is twice blessed by God, blessed by the oyster bed. What am I saying? What am I talking about? It doesn't matter. Just listen. I am speaking in tongues because it is, of course, the tongue that connects us, that redeems us, that sets us free. I often think these days of oral sex, the woman I love says, both ways. And there are my own flames that occur, reading her words, and the sense that the burning which has been promised will fail to happen. But I've been wrong before. And before that, wrong. But these things said, best we move on to Idaho, which is where I came nearly a year and a half ago, as an adult, as a believer, as someone hungry in more and more desperate ways to ascend through love, through God. Or is it descend, as the woman I love says, whichever. And there are angel of death mushrooms in Idaho. They grow in high meadows around sage. Their stems taper, their gills like flesh are pink. Careless reapers sometimes mistake angel of death for vision mushrooms. Both take your breath, but the angel of death are merciless. They paralyze in a minute. Seeking medical attention is unthinkable. Heart and brain in couple forget each other in a millisecond. The First Church of Idaho is precisely 7 miles from marshy flats strewn with Angel of Death.
It's David Cranes reading from his collection of stories, his new collection. It's called The Legend's Daughter, Stories by David Cranes. He's going to be speaking at the King's English Bookshop Saturday, May 11th at 7 o'clock. You can go to our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the writer David Cranes. We're talking about, well, a lot of things. Mostly is a new collection of stories, The Legend's Daughter, Stories by David Cranes. He's going to be reading from his book at the King's English Bookshop in May. We'll give you the details about that. Go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. I mentioned that for you, you've talked about how your writing doesn't necessarily begin with an idea. It begins with an impression or a voice or something. So once you have that, how does it unfold? I mean, and I ask this question of writers from time to time. Do you just sort of see where it goes? Do you envision an end place and try to get there? Do you just follow the characters, or is it different?
Yeah. I just let it go. I try to follow it. And I try to follow it to the most difficult place it might lead me. There are stations along the way as I'm imagining where such an image, how it might be, how what kind of characters might be involved, what the situation is. Mm-hmm. And I try not to stop at the easy point.
So it's not the path of least resistance.
No. Yeah. I know that I'm onto something when what I'm imagining and sketching and beginning drafts of scares me. When I think this is very, very dangerous. If I go this far, this is going to get this really become troubling for me as a writer, and hopefully troubling in the best ways of troubling for the reader. But yeah. It's very, very important for me not to take the easy way out of something. Someone else who you've had on this program, Bill Harley, says a story, you don't know really what a story is until it's over, if you're taking it from something in yourself, and you've got to be on the other side. So I want to go to that distance.
I wonder, the stories that came to you that are in this collection, you've talked about this, and I mentioned this earlier in the introduction, that for you, a lot of the question is, what's the container for the story? All right, I've got the story. Now what do I do with it? Because as I said, you've done all kinds of things with these stories, radio dramas and plays and novels. How did you know these stories were going to end up in a collection? You just sort of let them – I mean, how do you figure that out?
Well, as I said, I wrote the stories, and then there they were. Nine stories. But in some cases, you know, I can think of a couple of cases. I started the story as a one-act play, huh. And I thought, no, there's something wrong about putting this on stage. I'll put it. Let me put it in a narrative. So some of the stories tried to be in different containers and weren't there, and I hope that they're in the right. There's a story in there in the collection called
he's headed for the table of contents.
The Fish Magician.
Yeah.
And I won't say anything about it except it of any of the stories that don't seem to be in the right place, that doesn't seem to be in the right place. And it became a novel. There is a novel coming out, hopefully in a month, called Abracadabra, which employs the same situation but just sort of opens it up in many, many ways. Yeah.
So I want to – there's a story called The Conservationist and the Storyteller in this collection. Let's talk about Blake Fisher, a man you describe in the story as having generous affections, but a man who wants to get away from time to time when the stresses of his life, you know, he flees, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
Where did Blake come from?
Well, of all the stories, this story comes from two people who have been friends of mine, who I care deeply, deeply about. And at one point, one of them has since passed away, the figure who Blake is modeled after. And a couple of years before that, he who is Western and has a ranch in Idaho, did meet a character very much like Betsy, the storyteller.
Yeah.
And it was a brief meeting, but they both felt enormous affection for one another.
Yeah.
A deep kind of caring, just so that it was so instantaneous. I think I'd never seen that happen on both. There was nothing unseemly about it. It just was too large and feeling and wonderful people just feeling sudden affection. So I wanted, as a kind of tribute, this story began to be a tribute to two people I care about, just to put them together in a limited time, but in enough time to care as they did.
Yeah. It's such a sort of passing. As you said, they instantaneously kind of have some sort of connection. It's hard to explain. Probably don't have time for you to read this entire section, but I wonder if you could read a part of it. And do we need to set that up at all, David, or is that do you think it'll go from there?
I think we can just go from there. In the story, her car has broken down, and he says he knows somebody who can fix it, but it will be the next day. And so he generously said, come and stay at my ranch, and it's fine. I'm safe. And she is delighted to do that. So he is very, very proud of the ranch that he has. He's done a lot to restore it to its original and the water that goes by it, the stream that goes by it, to its original state, and loves that there are birds that come there. So he has a love of this outside world. They moved to chairs on the front porch, and Betsy told her story. In it, her lawyer son and his partner had lived through a winter in which seven of their gay friends had been lost to HIV. To absorb the grief, the two partners who lived within the D.C. Beltway had taken a spring trip to the West. One of the friends they'd lost had spoken rapturously about Redfish Lake in Stanley, and so they rented a cabin there. It was, in its way, a honeymoon, Betsy said. When they arrived, they couldn't help but notice all the defoliated and fallen conifers in the area. When they asked, they were told, the pine beetle. All night long, Betsy said, in their log cabin, the two men held each other and wept. They had left the blight to travel to the blight. The next morning when they hiked to the lodge for breakfast, it was impossible not to note an almost crimson tinge on the water. When they asked, they were told, the salmon are back. The lake was called Redfish Lake because at one point thousands of coho returned from the ocean to spawn. Word was you could walk across the lake on their backs, and then dams were built, return denied, abundance faded. But now, changes had been made, access had been returned. Redfish Lake was again Redfish Lake. Her son and her son's partner wept again, again held each other. They committed to adopting a child. There was the pine beetle and there was life renewal. They wept and chose life renewal. And that's the story of my homosexual lawyer son, Betsy said. When she turned finally to Blake in the dark, his hand was over his chest. "Are you all right?" she asked. "I think so," he said. "Maybe the steak was too rare," she said. "Fish, I think, always trump red meat," he said. He felt tired and a bit fragile. "I think I'm going to turn in," he said. "Keep on turning," Betsy said. "Fleetwood Mac," Blake said. Betsy laughed. "Well, how about that? I'm impressed."
That's David Cranes reading from his collection of stories called The Legend's Daughter, Stories by David Cranes. And he's going to be reading at the King's English Bookshop in May, May 11th. We'll give you the details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. David Cranes, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Doug. Thank you for having me here.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.